adjust my headphones. I cut a little hair off, so things are a little bit looser. Outside my head, not inside my head. Things are still nice and tight inside the head. We start out today's Issues Etc. with Julie Stiegelmeyer. She's the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for April. It's a children's book called Mommy Promises. We're going to talk about Christianity and motherhood. There is a passage in Scripture wherein God compares himself to a mother, not necessarily in a favorable way. He talks about how a mother can forget her children, or perhaps even her newborn children. But God assures us that he will never forget us. He says, I will never forget you. I've carved you on the palm of my hands. That's from the prophet Isaiah. We're going to talk about a mother's love and our Heavenly Father's love for us in Jesus Christ here in the first 20 minutes of Issues Etc. Julie Stiegelmeyer will be our guest. Then Serge Trifkovic is going to join us. We're going to talk about jihad. He has an amazing and, I will say, scary new book that he has written called Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terror Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. Is terrorism, Islamic terrorism, the same thing as jihad? First question for Sergio when we get him on the air. Then in the second hour of the program, we're going to spend a few minutes with Marianne Hackett of Illinois Right to Life talking about Kathleen Parker's column today in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch about an abortion case in Illinois that she says is full of all sorts of tricky ethical issues. And then to round off that hour, Scott Klusendorf joins us, the Missouri Stem Cell Initiative, and his reaction to our interview with Don Rubin, president of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures. Scott will join us there at about 4:15. At 5 o'clock, we're going to break the last hour into two halves. The first is going to be audio open lines. We've got a lot of things to bring to you in audio open lines. Your reaction to each and everything we bring to you is invited. And then in the last half hour, we're going to play Name That Religion. Now, we have played Name That Church Body, where we just play a snippet, a bit, from a sermon, usually a sermon, from a minister of some kind, Christian minister usually. And we simply ask you, our listeners, to name the denomination. What denomination is this? We've played this before. Now, this is just a twist on that. Name That Religion. We've actually got four sound bites. We're going to play them in rapid-fire succession. We'll tell you your options. Well, in this group of sound bites, there's a Lutheran, there's a Catholic, there's a Muslim, and there's a Jew. We'll play all four of them. We'll ask you, put them in order. What order are we playing them in? That's the last half hour of Issues Etc. Julie Stiegelmeyer joins us here for the first 20 minutes. She is a mother and a freelance writer in Pittsburgh. She's author of several books, including our Issues Etc. book of the month for April, Mommy Promises. Julie, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Nice to be with you.
Julie, how did becoming a mother? I think I've even met your children at a Higher Things, or maybe I haven't. I'm not sure.
It's possible. Last summer we had our son with us in St. Louis.
I think I did. How did becoming a mother change, deepen your perspective on God's love for us sinners in Jesus Christ?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, motherhood, being a parent, I think in general, but especially motherhood for me, has been a real blessing in many ways, and it has taught me so much about my own limitations, the fact that I'm not a very patient person. It reminds me of that daily. I think about the fact that I often am selfish. I am weak. I falter. I lose my temper, and it reminds me that of what a gracious God we truly have. And as much as I love my son and want to care for him and provide the best for him, it's nowhere near what our Heavenly Father wants to give to us.
One thing I discovered very early after our kids were old enough to interact with us verbally, mm-hmm, was that they very quickly caught on to what a promise was all about.
Oh, definitely.
And they were quick to point out when Dad or Mom didn't keep a promise.
Yeah, I know. And my son, who's 10 now, he'll definitely say, oh, well, this was something you promised to do, if I made something that I was just saying off the cuff and I hadn't really thought it through. Well, I better stick to it. But the things that are that I talked about in the book are things that are, you know, basic promises that a mother is going to give to her child. And so you're definitely right. They understand that concept of promise right away.
Before we get into some of those promises between mother and child, what do we teach our children? What do our children observe? Or how can we use it as an opportunity to teach about God's faithfulness to his promises when we break ours? I mean, it happens all the time. We promise things that we can't deliver, or we make a promise and then sometimes it's not because we're unable, we're unwilling to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
So where is the opportunity there to teach about God's complete faithfulness to all his promises?
Well, the one page toward the end of the book, I did want to bring something like that in because, you know, I'm sinful and I'm not going to be able to keep all my promises. And as much as I might have good intentions, it's just not going to be able, you know, I may not be able to, or like you said, I may not want to, I may, something else may happen, but it really shows that, God is, we can show the difference and of how I am unable to keep my promises, but God always does. And that's why on the one page I wrote, you know, we ask for forgiveness together, because that's an important part of modeling, you know, the Christian life for a child.
You begin the promises between mother and child with the promise to, well, you begin with baptism, the promise to bring this child to baptism, and therein where God can make your child his child. Talk
right
about that.
Yeah, the way I structured the book, something I've learned in the last couple of years as I've been writing more and more picture books and manuscripts that may become picture books someday, I've learned a lot about structure and how to lay out a book in a way that I kind of do a storyboard where it's like a little thumbnail sketch of the entire book on one page. And what I decided to do with Mommy Promises is to begin with the very first promises you make to your child when that child is born and when you bring that child to baptism. And that was really where I wanted to begin, that our relationship and any promises I would make would begin together as this child would become one of God's children. So that was where I really felt like it was important to start the story. And then what I did with the rest of the book is I just went all the way through childhood and so began with the infant years and then moved on into preschool and school age and, you know, into other promises as the child would grow older.
The parents' part, I guess you could say in kind of a crude way, mm-hmm. of those promises made at baptism, we actually even ask our parents to make these promises publicly before the church and God, that they would place into the hands of their children baptized the Holy Scriptures and bring them to the services of God's house. I think at one point Luther even says those are the most important duties God gives to parents, even above keeping our children alive, well-fed, warm, and clothed and housed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if that's the number one function of parents is to bring this child to God, to bring this child to the place where he or she can receive God's gift of forgiveness and grace through the Word and through the sacraments. And that is that's why it's, you know, the opening place where we're going to begin any discussion of promises. This is where we start. And then, you know, move on from there.
You talk about it in the book as promises that you're still learning to keep.
Mm-hmm.
And I often, as a parent, find myself in the position, you know, quoting those scriptural words, the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak, because I love my children, Julie. I mean, with kind of an involuntary kind of love that I don't think anyone experiences really before they have kids.
Yeah.
You can't help it. Even mm-hmm. when you don't particularly want to love them, and it hurts to love them, you still do.
Right.
And yet, we model for our children also how good we are at sinning and how good we are at putting ourselves before them, even as much as we do love them.
Right. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, that sort of involuntary love, because I mean, it's sort of a crude example, but I remember when my son was young, changing his diaper is nothing like changing another child's diaper. Because it's your child. It's, you know, there is this bond that is just, you can't explain to someone. And I remember another sort of vivid example when my son was about 5 and he was crossing the street in front of our house and there was a car coming and it was pretty close. He was crossing the street behind some kids that he thought were sort of taking care of him and they really weren't. And it wasn't like a super close call, but, you know, at that moment, you know, the sort of physical, for me, the physical reaction to his own safety, that's something that, yeah, I've never experienced, you know, any other way. But yeah, as much as there is that bond and that attachment, there is still a lot of times when it's almost like because you love them so much or because you're so attached that then the things they do, it's almost, you know, grates on you or something, you know, if there's an argument or, you know, there's the constant bickering or whatever it may be. It's very easy to see myself, everything in myself magnified as a mom. Maybe you know, the patience I thought I had before I was a mom, nope, don't have any of that. You know, so it's like it's parenting magnifies all your faults.
I remember after our kids were born and growing up And my younger brother, who's 10 years younger than me, and his wife were just having their first.
Mm-hmm.
And telling him once, look, I'm not a very emotional person, especially when it comes to things like anger. I don't get angry very easily. And I think it takes a lot to get me to that point. But I told my younger brother, look, you have no idea what it means to be mad yet. Until your kid makes you mad.
Yeah.
And then you're mad at a whole different level.
Yeah.
Than you ever were before, beyond anything you thought you ever could be.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's because the relationship of parent and child is so involving.
Yeah, I think that must be it. And there's just that really strong attachment. And it's, so you're doubly proud of them when they accomplish something great. And you're their, you know, best fan on the sidelines when they're playing a game. But then it's also, you know, it's rough when there are things when they do something that's wrong. And the thing that I'm in the stage right now is the arguing. You know, I say something, argument. Say something, you know, and I just lose it after a while. Oh, that can be very frustrating.
Well, your book does this beautifully. It paints a realistic picture of Christian parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
And a very kind of not only realistic but down-to-earth picture of Christian parenthood, a very vocational picture. That is, the things like brushing the teeth and listening to their questions rather than reading books about how to be a perfect parent. Why is it, do you think, that in Christian literature, very often the stuff aimed at the parents, an ideal picture is painted of what it means to be a mom? Or a dad?
Well, I think it's so important what you mentioned about vocation. If we don't come back to that, then it's just constantly going to be, you know, the law on us, you know, telling us to do what's right and do this and do that. And the thing, I was sitting the other day reading a little, it's edited by Roland Baton. It's Martin Luther's Easter book, just little snippets from Martin Luther. And I was reading the Palm Sunday selection, and he was talking about how your king comes to you, and he comes to you. You don't come to him. He gives you faith. You don't have faith on your own. And then he started going into vocation. And I was sitting there. I'd come home from my son's baseball practice, had a headache, was cranky. It was 5 o'clock. I had to cook dinner. And I didn't want to cook dinner. I said, let's get a pizza. But then I thought, then I was reading this great stuff by Luther, and he says, Christ gives you everything. Now what you do is you serve your neighbor because your neighbor needs you. And it just reminded me again of that vocation of mother, and in that case, vocation of wife, where I can serve my the people in my family by cooking them dinner. So I got up and cooked dinner.
Oh, you did? I was going to ask, did you order a pizza? Did you make Scott run out and get you a pizza, or did you actually cook dinner?
I actually cooked dinner that night.
You know, there's nothing wrong with ordering pizza every
once in a while. Oh, I know. There wasn't. But, you know, sometimes obviously. But I just, that night it was sort of one of those things where I thought it was really good to kind of get my mind set straight because I was feeling really cranky. And I thought that was a nice little selection from that book.
Our children will not immediately appreciate, or perhaps even for many decades, appreciate some of the promises that parents keep mm-hmm. and have to keep with them when they're young. Talk about that a bit.
Well, I've thought about, after I became a mom, I thought a lot about my parents. And I think as adult children, when adults have kids, often I think their relationship with their parents sometimes changes. And I have a new appreciation for what they, you know, what they sacrificed, what they did for me and my brothers as we were growing up. And so I think that, you know, it's not, and I don't know if our son will even recognize, you know, some of the things that we do for him until he himself becomes a father, you know, assuming he would someday. And it's just partly going through the experience and what it, you know, what it all encompasses to really come to that understanding.
Well, two final questions before I let you go, Julie. This is a picture book, and you mm-hmm. even mentioned that when you were structuring the book before writing it, you very often sit down and do a storyboard, actually thinking about what it's going to look like, not just how it's going to read on the page. Talk a bit about the illustrations that go along with your text in Mommy Promises.
Well, it was really great. Last fall, I was in St. Louis, and I got to go to Concordia Publishing House and meet the designer who designed the book. I didn't meet the illustrator. That was someone else. But someone at Concordia kind of walked me through some of the design elements of the book, which were really nice. She actually found this fabric that she really liked and thought maybe we could use this, you know, as the edging on the cover and on, you know, the sides of the pages. And she had to get they had to get permission, actually, to use that fabric design. And that is just such a nice element that goes through the whole thing. The illustrations are sort of this soft, I don't know what they are, probably acrylic. And I really, really like how they came out because they're very warm and really, I think, match the tone of the text pretty well, which is often really important in picture books. And so the design really worked together as a whole with the illustrations and the design elements and the text. So
do you have a favorite illustration?
I really like, I like two. I like the baptism one, and I like the one with the little toddler tucked in the crib, just because I have a picture almost like that of my son that I just love, that little perfect profile, you know, you remember of your kids. So, and there were some personal touches I added in the book, actual questions that he asked when he was little, the why kittens have whiskers and where the wind comes from, and our favorite family cookie really is the peanut butter chocolate chip. And so it was fun to add those elements in there, too.
And then finally, talk lastly about why this book, Mommy Promises, would make an excellent Mother's Day gift.
Well, I do think it would be a nice gift for mothers. I could see mothers giving it to their children as well. It's a sharing book. It's I think child friendly, but it also speaks to the adult, and that's one thing you want to be careful of when you're writing children's books. You want to make sure this is actually for the kids. And I think it worked out to be a nice balance of those two things. It would be a great, I think, something really nice for new moms just to they could think about. And share with their child as the child grows older. But also for children to, I also think it would be a nice gift for kids. So it's kind of for moms and their children.
Julie Stiegemeyer is a mother and a freelance writer in Pittsburgh. Quite a writer, by the way. And she's author of several books, including Our Issues, Etc., a book of the month for April called Mommy Promises. Julie, thanks for being our guest.
Well, thanks for having me and for choosing this as your book of the month. That was very nice.
We were happy to do it. Well, we don't do this very often on Issues, Etc. In fact, this may be the first time. I'm going to give this book away. I've got a copy in front of me. I'm going to give it away to the 14th caller. I don't know why 14th. Jeff just said give it away to the 14th caller, and that's what I'm going to do. So start calling now, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And if you're 14th in line, I'll give you a copy of Julie Stiegemeyer's Mommy Promises, Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for April. And for those of you who call but don't get it, well, you can call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for Mommy Promises, The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for April by Julie Stiegemeyer. You can also visit our website and browse before you buy, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. When you call that number, I'm sorry, when you go to the website, right there on the homepage, where you usually find the Book of the Month, you will find Mommy Promises. Now, again, to the 14th caller, just call, and if you're 14th, I'm going to give you a copy of this book, Mommy Promises. Great Mother's Day gift. Or, as Julie said, if you want, as a mother, to give it to your kids on Mother's Day, that'll work too. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Serge Trifkovic is a regular guest here on the program. He has written a book called Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terror Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. For the remainder of this segment and then into the next, we're going to talk to him about jihad. He's foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. Sergio, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
It's good to be with you again.
We've only got a minute here before we go to a break. In fact, even less. Very quickly, is Islamic terrorism jihad?
It's very difficult to separate the two, because when we have divinely condoned violence as a means of achieving religious ends, and if it's prescribed in the Holy Scripture of Muslim religion as something that you not only are able to do, but are in fact obligated to do, then the borderline becomes very thin indeed.
When we come back from this break, that's the beginning of our conversation with Sergio Trifkovic. It is very difficult to distinguish between Islamic terrorism and jihad. Well, are the two consistent with one another? Is the Islamic religion, of necessity, a religion of jihad? What is jihad? How do we respond to those who say, no, jihad is the spiritual struggle, and any good Muslim would turn away from violence and struggle inwardly against his own passions and desires to be obedient to Allah? We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. Our call-in number is 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Your questions and comments for Sergey can also be sent via email right here into our studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. More with Sergey Trifkovic on jihad after this.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
There is nothing like the relationship between a mother and her child. Nothing. And that relationship is only surpassed by the relationship between our Heavenly Father and His children in Jesus Christ. These two themes, our earthly mothers and our Heavenly Father, are brought together in a beautifully illustrated children's book. It's our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April. It's called Mommy Promises by Issues, Etc. regular guest Julie Stiegemeyer. Mommy Promises is available from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy and find the book at our website, issuesetc.org. Mommy Promises is right there on the homepage, issuesetc.org. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, Mommy Promises by Issues, Etc. regular guest Julie Stiegemeyer, 1-800-325-3040.
From the National Institutes of Health, this is NIH Health Matters,
A study supported by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences found that individuals with diets rich in meat, refined starches, and sodium are nearly 1.5 times more likely to report new onsets of persistent coughing with phlegm than those who consume a diet high in fruit and soy. Dr. Stephanie London, lead investigator of the study, says understanding the role that diet plays will lead to better prevention and treatment of respiratory diseases.
Although smoking is absolutely the major risk factor for chronic respiratory symptoms and illness, these data provide additional support for the idea that diet may play a role in both good ways, things like fiber intake, and in bad ways.
Dr. London said the data shows the important contribution that diet can have on the development of diseases. From Bethesda, Maryland, I'm Bill Schmalfelt. This has been NIH Health Matters.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I remember a phone call from a member of my first congregation. Are you busy? I answered, I'm studying. Good, she said, then I can talk to you. Many Americans, practical-minded people, think of teaching and learning as a leisurely pursuit, not as productive as real work. But what does countercultural Jesus do on Tuesday and Wednesday of Holy Week? He teaches his disciples. Maybe the closer you get to important work, the more you should retreat, rest, and learn from Jesus. It's in rest that the Spirit teaches us the truth, freeing yourself for some time every day, freeing yourself from unrelenting work and for devotional rest, enables you to ponder the truths of your being and salvation. Rest in the Bible isn't only about us, it's about us being with God. The seventh day was to be a Sabbath of rest to the Lord, not self-centered rest, says Exodus 35, verse 2. You don't have to be a hunter to know it's easier to hit a sitting target than a moving one. That's why Jesus sat his disciples down for teaching before his bitter work. In the same way, his Spirit will specially bless you when you suspend work to learn from him. Don't just do something. Sit there. Augustine says, our hearts are restless until they rest in thee.
Holy Week offers a number of special worship opportunities, and AM 850 KFUO will provide a number of special broadcasts. On Monday, Thursday, we'll broadcast a live service from Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church in North St. Louis County. That's at 11 a.m. On Good Friday, we'll broadcast our traditional Traore, or three-hour service, beginning at noon from Messiah Lutheran Church on South Grand Boulevard in St. Louis. Live Monday, Thursday, and Good Friday worship from AM 850 KFUO, inspirational Christian radio for the world.
Well, congratulations to Aaron, listening in Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. He got our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, Mommy Promises. He was a 14th caller. Thank you very much for everybody who called. Sergio Trifkovic is our guest. We're talking about jihad. He's written a book called Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terror Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. He's foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. Sergi, before the break, you mentioned that it's difficult to distinguish between Islamic terrorism and jihad. How would Islam define jihad?
It's the war in the path of Allah in the primary meaning, and the struggle against one's sinful yearnings in the secondary meaning. But it is noteworthy that very often this spiritual definition of jihad is invoked by Islamic apologists. And yet, within the Islamic jurisprudence and Islamic tradition, you can only practice this inner jihad once the real variety, the one red in tooth and claw, is over. And once the world of faith, Dar al-Islam, has triumphed over the world of war, Dar al-Harb.
How central is the idea of jihad to Islam?
Well, we have to distinguish between the scriptural references to it in the Quran and the even more bloodthirsty and certainly more bellicose traditions of the Prophet, so-called hadith, in which various sayings and deeds of Muhammad recorded. Now, we have to bear in mind also that in the Quran you will find some eminently peaceful-sounding verses, but there is a great deal of difference between Muhammad, the marginalized preacher in Mecca, and after 622, when he moved to Medina, Muhammad, the vengeful warlord. And also not many non-Muslims realize that in the Quranic tradition, the principle of abrogation applies. In other words, that those later revelations, the ones that came in Medina, which are full of jihadist references and of open invitations and exhortations to use violence against the infidels, actually abrogate those earlier Meccan verses, such as there is no compulsion in religion. So we have to bear in mind that jihad is integral to the Islamic mindset, because Islam divides the world into a Manichaean kind of black and white sense of us and them. And there is no way that you can wriggle out of the both philosophical and moral implications of that paradigm. It, in fact, is highly reminiscent of the dualist mindset of the Bolsheviks, you know, the first country of socialism or the socialist camp, and the enemy around us, and sooner or later it is our preordained historical duty to conquer the enemy.
You point out in the book that Islam either stands or falls on the person of Muhammad, and it sounds like, especially from your historical treatment of Muhammad's view, especially his view of other people, those outside the world of Islam, as he progresses, he becomes harsher, especially against Christians and Jews in his rhetoric. So perhaps what we're dealing with today are, at least in a rough sense, Muslims who prefer the early Muhammad. They would be more peace-loving, more conciliatory and ironic, to those who prefer the later Muhammad.
Yes, but the trouble is that we've seen something similar with the attempt of by reformist-minded Marxists in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe before the fall of the Iron Curtain to rediscover the so-called young Marx and to invent a socialism with a human face. When the chips are down, it's always the adherents of the harsher variety of the tradition that will have the upper hand, because they're both scripturally and philosophically and temperamentally much closer to the truth about both Muhammad and his legacy.
So, in the end, we will be dealing with Muhammad as he was in his final state and as he left his legacy upon Islam.
Unfortunately. And the fact is that had he died in the first or second year after his move from Mecca to Medina, undoubtedly the legacy would have been different. But at the same time, without jihad, it's hardly conceivable that Islam would have spread so rapidly and so far and wide. Because let's face it, whereas Christianity was spreading through the Roman Empire under the pain of death, many people were literally risking their lives and yet proselytizing to each other, and they were very harshly treated by Diocletian, for instance. Islam had to rely on the sword all the time. And the way that it spread along North African coast into the Iberian Peninsula, only to be stopped by Charles Martel in southern central France, and the way it spread into the Fertile Crescent, into Mesopotamia, and into the Balkans, was entirely due to the legacy of jihad. It was not a spontaneous and incremental spread.
You write this, Sergio: Islam creates among its adherents the paradigm of a permanent cosmic war that breeds the terrorist worldview. What do you mean by that?
What I referred to a minute ago by the Manichaean dualist black and white vision of the world, it is us and them, or to be more accurate, us against them. It's what the Russians would call kto kogo, who will get whom. The notion of peaceful coexistence is alien to Islam. In other words, wherever you have the tectonic fault line between Islam and other faiths and other cultures, you will have conflict. And indeed, it has been so throughout history, and it still is so to this day, whether we are talking about East Timor, whether we are talking about the Spice Islands, or about southern Philippines, whether we are talking about southern Thailand, or about Kashmir, about the Balkans, or about the Caucasus. Wherever you have this fault line, you have conflict. And if we were to exclude from the contemporary conflicts the strife between Muslims and non-Muslims, the world would suddenly appear an eminently peaceful place.
What do you mean by this, then? Islam has created a moral philosophy and a legal code that, in principle, allows terrorist acts. What are you talking about there in particular?
Well, I'm talking in particular about not so much the Quranic quotes, but the hadith in which it is specifically stated that, for instance, you can use the catapult, which is a weapon of mass destruction of the 7th century, even if it means that some innocents will be slain, because it is a greater good to conquer a besieged city than to refrain from harming those within its walls. Actually, Al-Qaeda has developed a highly sophisticated and well-argued string of arguments in favor of using random violence, i.e. terrorism, which is eminently Islamic. And it is possible for Islamic scholars maybe to dispute this quote or that quote and the context in which they're using the example of the Prophet, but what they cannot dispute is that these sources are undisputably Islamic. In fact, I would venture to say that those who want to reinvent an allegedly peaceful and tolerant Islam are the revisionists, and those who trust in jihad as a means of spreading their faith and their control over unbelievers are the ones who are true to the tenets of their teaching and their faith.
What becomes of individual conscience in Islam?
Not much, because, let's face it, there is no sense of natural morality in Islam. A thing is right or wrong entirely on the basis of whether the Prophet has done so or whether Allah has said so in the Quran. In other words, we are looking at purely nominalistic ethical and legal system in which there is simply no scope for individual reasoning, and it is furthermore not allowed. You are simply not to question any of the Quranic injunctions or indeed of the Hadith. For as long as you follow these to the letter, you will be all right. You will probably earn your way to paradise with 72 huris and 28 scented boys, but you're not allowed to reason. You're not allowed to ask questions, metaphysical questions, ontological questions. You are not allowed to even have personal doubts within yourself, because even that in itself is an act of disbelief.
I want to come back to that, the whether or not Islam could even be able to reflect upon itself. If there's the seed within Islam to be self-reflective, but one other question. It's often been noted by many guests, including yourself, when we talk about Islam, that there is no real distinction between mosque and state, analogous to our separation of church and state, and the distinction that everyone makes between the two at the very least. So does religion become politics? Does religion become a political tool in Islam?
Well, in fact, I would say that you're asking the question the wrong way in terms of Islamic world outlook, because the very notion of dividing the political sphere from the religious sphere is utterly alien to it. Islam is a totality of existence. It is both a religion and a legal code and the blueprint for political action. So any attempt to pigeonhole the human experience into politics, religion, morals, etc., would, from the Islamic point of view, be heretical.
Let's talk about a story that's in the near the end of the book here. You talk about a trip that was made by two of your colleagues, one of them a regular guest here on the program, Aaron Wolf, but also Scott Reichert. And they visited a Rockford, Illinois school, the ICRA school, back in January of 2002, and heard the children there singing songs. Tell the story.
I'm afraid I don't have a copy of my book in front of me, so that I won't be able to reproduce the unbelievable little song word for word. But to cut the long story short, obviously expecting that Scott Richards and Aaron Wolf will be just another couple of politically correct mainstream journalists who will buy the story of the Religion of Peace and Tolerance line, Hook and Sinker, the hosts were very gracious in letting them spend some time with the kids who were totally at ease. And they performed songs that were frankly, you know, spreading hate, that had they been presented by little Christians in a Christian school and directed against non-Christians, then certainly the letter of the law would have been used against that school for spreading hate. And it came down to their prayer to Allah to give them strength to fight the infidels and to subjugate them. And that was regarded as perfectly comme il faut by the kids, who, by the way, did not display any personal animosity to the two visitors. It was simply taken for granted that this is what they should strive for and what they should hope for.
We're talking about jihad. Dr. Serge Trifkovic is our guest. He's foreign affairs editor for Chronicles Magazine, a magazine of American culture, author of the book Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terror Can Be Won, In Spite of Ourselves. Our in-studio email address, issues@kfuo.org. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You're listening to Issues Etc., and I'm Todd Wilkin. Serge, you point out early in the book that at least when it comes to American leadership, and here we talk about the war on terror, the real problem is undiagnosed. Talk about that.
What we keep hearing from various political leaders, and I'm talking not only about the United States, it's the same syndrome is present on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, is the almost desperate attempt to make a distinction between terrorism and the allegedly peaceful and tolerant real Islam. And we've all heard President Bush make references to that effect. In fact, in his speech to the National Endowment for Democracy last October, he went a step further and said that terrorists were distorting the idea of jihad. So he even advanced from claiming that Islam is essentially peaceful to actually asserting, at least indirectly, that jihad itself is inherently peaceful. And in Europe, probably the greatest culprit is Tony Blair, who says that we cannot even use the term Islamic terrorists because Islam being inherently peaceful is it would be a contradiction in terms to put those two words together. So this elite mindset is probably the greatest enemy of the Western world. For as long as this elusive terrorism is defined as the enemy, the war on terror cannot be won because it has to entail the rediscovery of our spiritual and moral roots and the reassertion of our civilizational identity and our civilizational worth. Unless and until the Western world does so, waging war on terror in the name of putrid and lukewarm multiculturalism is doomed to fail. But in addition, I must say that the sleepwalking is continuing not only among the political leaders, but even more outrageously in academia and in the mainstream media. For instance, only a few days ago, Chicago Tribune had an article by a DePaul professor by the name of Sherif Bassiouni, who claimed that Islam does not order death penalty for apostates and converts to Christianity, which is a white-faced lie. And we all know about the technique that is called in Arabic taqiyya, which is mandated dissimulation by Muslims to non-Muslims and false openly actually lying to infidels is both desirable and recommended. So the real Islam is the one that has 13 and a half centuries of violent interaction with its environment. The real Islam is the one that has left a trail of blood from its birthplace into all four areas of major conquest. One area went through North Africa and into Europe, the other into to what is today Pakistan and India, where we had some of the most horrendous episodes of jihadist violence. One went through the Mesopotamian Fertile Triangle into Caucasus, and the fourth went into the Balkans. And if and when there is a massive Quranic revision that would relativize these violent surahs and quotes, and which would take a critical attitude to the traditions of the Prophet, the Hadith, then maybe we can lower our guard. But in the meantime, just taking at face value the verbal pronouncements of Western bien-pensants and politicians is more than dangerous. It is actually both criminal and silly.
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jeff in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, listens on the Internet. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I was wondering, and I've kind of been thinking this for a few years now, if there's a connection between the denial of original sin and jihad and Islamic terrorism, because if you're constantly looking for an outside influence that's corrupting you, then you have to go get it on the outside as opposed to suspecting that we're inherently corruptible. Because I know Islam has a belief that a true Islamic state will always be victorious on the battlefield and, you know, will achieve great heights. So since Islamic culture has really declined since about 1400, they have to look for outside, you know, corrupting influence.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
This is an interesting point. And in fact, the denial of original sin is very closely linked to this purely prescriptive moral code that is based upon the literal application of Quranic quotes and the example of the Hadith. Both, in fact, dehumanize us by reducing the moral discernment and the ability to judge right and wrong through our own intellect and through our own moral faculties. But as for the second point, it is unfortunate that whenever there is a crisis in the relations between Islamic states and the rest of the world, when they are manifestly weak, for instance, in the period after the Turkish defeat at the gates of Vienna in 1683, there is invariably a strong wing within the Islamic world that insists that the weakness is due to insufficient application of the Prophet's commands. And the clamoring for more Islam as the solution to the crisis of the Islamic world creates a catch-22 situation in which neither a functional polity nor a functional economy can develop.
Jerry calls from South County. Jerry, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Ted. Hi. Thanks to your guest. And if he could repeat his book, may I ask his comment? What do you foresee for Turkey's government, which is still secular since 1923, but now it has a fundamentalist leaders, and they are definitely, you know, fundamentalist Muslim and Islamic inspired. What do you foresee for that, please? And I understand that there is a rule among Muslims that if you need to get to an end, it's okay to lie to get there.
All right, thank you, Jerry. What about Turkey? You know, always held up as a democracy wherein Islam coexists rather nicely. Do you share that assessment?
Well, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish prime minister, is undoubtedly a fundamentalist Muslim. And he was actually imprisoned for writing a poem in which he exalted our minarets, which are our rockets, and our domes, which are our helmets. To call him a post-Islamist is rather funny. It sounds a little bit like calling someone a post-Nazi or a post-fascist. Alianza Nazionale comes to mind. But the problem with Turkey is that it is currently in a situation somewhat comparable to Iran in the 1970s. It has a narrow stratum of a westernized middle class and technocracy. It has an army that is always ready to intervene if the Islamist tendencies assert themselves too loudly, but it also has a simmering volcano in the countryside where the majority of people undoubtedly share the sentiment of their co-religionists elsewhere. And even the most European of Turkish cities, Istanbul, the megalopolis of 6 million people, has a city council dominated by Erdogan's party. So the answer to your question is that, in the opinion of many experts, the problem of what will happen to Turkey is not an issue if, but when. When will it happen? And right now, the most worrying symptom is the fact that among the junior ranks in the Turkish army, the lieutenants and the colonels, for the first time, you have the emergence of Islamist cells. In the past, such tendencies were very rigorously clamped down, dealt with, but it is to be feared that once the Turkish army is infected with this syndrome, it will no longer be able to intervene, as it has done in the past, to replace the government with if it displays too heavily Islamic tendencies, and to protect and uphold the legacy of Kemal Atatürk. Now, the additional problem is that the United States government is still insistent that it is desirable for Turkey to join the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
And this is completely inexplicable, because if Turkey joins, then you can kiss Europe goodbye. It would overnight become the second most populous country in Europe, after Germany, with an infinitely greater fertility rate. And it would also mean that both in terms of cultural identity and in terms of demographic trends, the Turks would finally achieve what they failed to do back in 1683 with the siege of Vienna.
Sergey, can you stay with us for a few minutes on the other side of this break?
Sure.
All right. Then with only about 30 seconds here, perhaps begin a response to this question from Roland. He writes us via email. Is it foolish to assume, as some U.S. politicians do, that Muslims may be assimilated into a Western form of democratic rule if they do not forego strict adherence to Islam?
Well, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. You already have second and third generations of Muslims in Western Europe, the North Africans in France, the Turks in Germany, and the Pakistanis and Bangladeshis in Great Britain. And we do not see any manifestations of assimilation. If anything, the European-born young second and third generation Muslims are much more radical and much more committed than their parents and grandparents.
Well, when we come back, the big question is then, especially given the story that he told earlier about Aaron Wolf and Scott Richards' trip to that Islamic school in Rockford, Illinois, is that what we're looking forward to here in the United States, the second, the third, the fourth generation of Muslim immigrants being more radical, more like Mohammed and less like, well, what everyone calls this religion of peace? I also would like to get Dr. Trifkovic's response to a comment made recently by Thomas Friedman of the New York Times about humiliation being at the very heart of the terrorist impulse. We'll explain that and get his response on the other side of this break. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment as we talk about jihad with Dr. Sergey Trifkovic. 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.